Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, will data development get songwriters paid? Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
That was a weird way to introduce me. Hello there.
Gotta mix it up. Gotta mix it up. It gets boring, so maybe I should just change the script.
That would be all that now. After 87 years of using the same templates.
Oh, you just reminded me of something.
What?
This is the 5th anniversary edition of the Setlist.
Is it?
Yeah, I could have said that a bit more smoothly, but it's done now. There's no way of changing it.
5 years ago, we rebranded. Is that what you're saying?
I believe so.
I guess.
I mean, doesn't seem possible.
Whatever year that was, we must have taken a summer break. And then when we came back, you said, I'm bored of it being called the CMU podcast. Let's give it its own name. I remember that.
Yes. I said something along those lines.
And
yes.
We came
and
up
according
with-
to my calendar, let me just check. Let me just check, it is this week.
The other thing I remember is failing to come up with a better name than Setlist.
Setlist is a great name.
As is always the way.
Oh, do you know what? Have I?
With all the things no, I'm involved in, have you got it wrong? Is it 6.5 years since we became Setlist?
I can't. Oh, hang on. It will be, Setlist's 5th anniversary on the 7th of October, which will
neatly coincide with the next edition.
Yeah, well, we will be recording the next edition probably on the 5th anniversary, but it won't go out until
So the 5th anniversary later. Will occur while people are listening to this podcast.
But we could do a big 5th anniversary edition next week.
Well, maybe
and this
that's,
could be trailing it.
Maybe that's something to think about. And we can talk about
I suspect we won't do that.
I'm trying to imagine
that it happened.
I'm trying to describe the graphic that accompanies this edition of Setlist. The drumstick and cable and speaker imagery created by Andy Malt. We could do an exhibition, maybe, if it's the 5th anniversary. Do you think there's anyone out there
maybe
wanting to do an exhibition of the Andy Malt original artwork that accompanies this podcast? And let's not forget the theme tune. Maybe you could do a 37-minute remix and that could be next week's podcast.
Yeah. I mean, 37 minutes would be quite a lot longer than the podcast has been recently, but sure.
But of course, if you like the theme
these
tune...
These are all the big plans.
Don't forget that you can listen to the theme tune as a standalone track. It's over there on Spotify and all other streaming services because we needed it to explain music rights data at the Great Escape back in May. I'm turning that into another little presentation I'm going to be delivering at some point quite soon. So we did all of that in order to explain music rights data, which A, means you can go to your streaming service of choice and listen to a released version of a Setlist theme tune. Also, that's kind of relevant to one of the things we're going to be talking about today, but you've got to do this next bit of the script before we get into any of that.
Yes. So anyway, what we've established there is that either this week or next week is the 5th anniversary of Setlist, because the date sort of falls in between the two.
People are
welcome.
We can
just celebrate it twice.
Yeah. Maybe people could send us two cakes, one this week and one next week.
Yes.
To the usual...
I mean, we're in different places, so they'll have to send us four.
I was going to say to the usual address, but don't send it to the usual address, because actually that's a PO box in Shoreditch.
Where we very rarely
go to, so don't send cakes there. But if you want to send us cakes, get in touch and maybe we'll tell you somewhere you can send the cakes and we'll eat them. Maybe that's something we
can do. Yes, do email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. We'll tell you where to send cakes. This is good. Yeah, we'll definitely do this again next week. I mean, if it goes well.
Given that we... apparently are going to be abandoning the Setlist script template in the name of innovation. I think that's how this conversation began. Maybe just one last time for this 5th anniversary edition, we should stick to the script and you can say something along the lines of, I don't know, maybe as ever we're going to be looking back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. Something like that, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect this will also be the same next week. But anyway, as ever, we're going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. a week when The Great Escape announced details about its first 50 shows that will take place in London in November, and more importantly, the thing that everyone wants to know, the key themes were revealed for the CMU TGE sessions that will sit at the very heart of the TGE conference in Brighton next May, with the spotlight falling this time on Chris.
Music and education, music and deals, and music and the creator economy. But before I say any more about the conference strands that CMU will be presenting at The Great Escape next year, I feel I ought to clarify the first bit of that there that you read out. The way you intonated it, I think, made it sound like what The Great Escape had announced are the first 50 shows that will be taking place rather than the first 50 shows that will be taking place. Yeah, it's quite hard to intonate, isn't it?
I think that's how I tried to do it.
I think it's
first 50 is their annual event.
It is.
In London, where they unveil the first 50 acts on next year's lineup with live shows.
So that
very
is
easy to understand.
That is what was announced last week by The Great Escape on the music side. So it's basically a bunch of showcases in 8 venues in London in November, which will coincide with the announcement of the first 50 shows playing TGE 2023. And some of those first 50 acts to be announced will also be playing at those shows. So that is what was announced on the festival side. Meanwhile, in terms of the conference, yes, CMU once again will be curating and hosting the core conference strands that sit within the Great Escape Conference for the 3,500 music industry people who attend the Great Escape Festival each year. And as always, we are basically organising the core conference strands around these 3 themes. So we'll have a whole day discussing music education. Now, we do this every year, but it's where we bring together music education and the music industry, and we talk about trends in the way that people learn about both music making and the music industry, and building bridges between education and industries. So that will be the focus on the first day, on the Wednesday of Great Escape 2023, next May in Brighton. On the Thursday, it's all about deal making in the music industry. So we're going to be looking at the deals that artists do with their business partners, record deals, publishing deals, their deals with promoters and agents and managers, and how those deals are changing, the choices that artists now need to make, the different approaches. We'll also be looking at the deals that the music industry does with users of music, streaming services, other digital platforms, media, brands, etc. So that will be the focus on the Thursday. Meanwhile, on the Friday of Great Escape Week, we're going to be putting the focus on the wider creator economy, looking at all of the tools and platforms and digital communities which music makers now use to create music, to find collaborators and projects and to get their music out there, and also to build a fan base and build a relationship with their fan base and monetize that relationship. We'll also be looking at how YouTube and TikTok creators and podcasters are using different tools to grow their businesses and what the music community can learn from that. And we'll put the spotlight on all of those beats and stems and sample marketplaces and communities that now exist and finding out how they work. So those will be the core strands that CMU presents at Great Escape 2023. As well as that, of course, there'll be lots of other stuff happening within the conference, the In Conversations, the partner panels, and lots of other things besides, as well as the festival stuff that is happening. So we'll put some links, I am sure, in the podcast notes to where you can find information about those first 50 shows happening in London in November. Actually, that's next month by the time this podcast goes out, isn't it? Is it October by the time this podcast goes out?
Sure is.
So next month, the first 50 shows in London.
Setlist's fifth anniversary month.
Of course. How could I have forgotten? And we'll give you a link to where you can get information on those core strands that are happening at The Great Escape from a CMU perspective next year, and how you can get your delegate passes, which will get you in to everything. So that's some Great Escape plugging for you. I'm sure you've all been sitting there each week a set list comes out thinking, when are we going to get some Great Escape plugging? When in the year does that begin? Well, it begins at the start of October. Now you know. So that's the first Great Escape plugging of this year. Well, this academic year, I guess. This Great Escape year. Does that make sense?
I think so.
It doesn't matter if it makes sense, because it's not what we're here to talk about this week.
No, it's not. Later on, we're going to be discussing Pusha T's latest McDonald's diss track. But first, there were a couple of announcements last week in the UK and the US regarding access to data about song rights. So in the UK, the collecting society PRS for Music set out plans to launch a new online portal that will provide easy access to key data linked to the song's catalogue that it represents. Meanwhile, in the US, the Mechanical Licensing Collective, or MLC, launched a new tool that allows music distributors to access data on unclaimed mechanical royalties for over 2 million recordings.
Yeah, so these were both interesting developments, as I alluded to earlier, in relation to music rights data and the importance of getting music rights data right in order to make sure, well, ultimately, that artists and songwriters get paid whenever their music is streamed or otherwise utilised. But I guess before we get into the nitty-gritty of these announcements, I mean, let's just think about the challenges that these announcements and other similar initiatives are seeking to resolve. Anybody, and I imagine in the setlist audience, there are some people where this is your job. Anybody who has tried to license music for a movie or a game or an advert, so I guess that's music for synchronization. But those are scenarios where if you're synchronizing music, you cannot rely on a blanket license from a collecting society where basically you go and get one license from one entity and you can pretty much use whatever music you like under that license. No, with those sorts of sync deals, you actually have to go out and find who owns the copyright in whichever recording and or song you want to use and negotiate a deal. And working out who owns the copyright in any one song or recording can be a pretty tricky thing to do. Two reasons. Reason number one, copyright is an automatic right in law. So unlike trademarks, another kind of intellectual property, where in order to get trademark protection around a name or a brand, you have to go through a formal registration process and register your mark with a registry. With copyright, the minute a song is written, the minute a recording is made, the copyright in that piece of work exists. It is true that in some countries there are copyright registries where you can register those works. But even where that's the case, the US for example, the copyright still exists as soon as the work is created. Meanwhile, in places like the UK, we have no copyright registration, no formal copyright registry. So there isn't a statutory body, certainly here in the UK and in many countries around the world, that will tell you, oh yeah, that song, that recording, this is who owns the copyright. Meanwhile, the music industry has not quite got round to creating the one-stop shop global database of music rights. There have been various...
Maybe one day.
Efforts to do that. Everyone agrees it should exist, but it doesn't. Instead, in every single country, the music industry, usually through its collecting societies, has set up databases of both songs and recordings. The quality of those databases differs greatly around the world. None of those databases are truly comprehensive. Quite a lot of the data in those different databases around the world probably doesn't agree, which is to say that you might have one database on one side of the world that says these people own that song copyright. Remember, with song copyrights in particular, often there's co-ownership. Another database on the other side of the world might have different people owning the copyright, or even if they agree who the owners are, they may not agree on the splits. So there are many, many, many databases, and they don't necessarily agree. None of them are comprehensive. And I guess most relevant to the first of the announcements last week is those databases are not generally publicly accessible. Some of them might make some of the data available by a website, but in many, many cases, those collecting society databases are only available to members of the society. Yes, if you're a member, you can go in and see data around the works in which you have an interest, but a lot of the data contained in those databases is not available to the public. So this makes doing any sort of music licensing, unless you can rely on blanket licenses from collecting societies, really tricky. And it has also had an impact, as we've talked about a lot on Setlist, in how streaming and the licensing and payment of streaming royalties on the song side of the business works.
Yeah, as you say, issues around music rights data have added complexities to the way songs are licensed to streaming services and digital royalties paid to songwriters, which means writers generally experience many more delays and admin costs compared to recording artists as their streaming income is processed. One particular issue is the linking of each recording to the song it contains. So matching the ISRC that identifies the recording to the ISWC that identifies the song. Now, as part of the processing of digital royalties, various entities, often within or owned by the collection societies, are matching recordings to songs on a constant basis. But, like the ownership data, that matching data often isn't publicly accessible, which makes it hard to spot when different entities have matched the same recording to different songs, or where recordings haven't been matched to a song at all.
Yeah, so if you are a songwriter in particular, and these data issues tend to affect songwriters more than artists, as we've already said, if you are a songwriter or you're the manager of the songwriter or an accountant of the songwriter, you know that there's all these different bits of data, that matching data, matching the ISRCs to ISWCs, and then the data around who owns any one song copyright and where there's co-ownership, how it's split. You know that that data is really important in making sure that whenever your songs are streamed, wherever it is in the world, that the money is claimed from the streaming services by your business partners. That might be a publisher, it might be a collecting society, and the money comes in and then it goes through the system and ultimately ends up in your bank account as a songwriter. So as a writer or the manager of the writer, you know that data is absolutely crucial. And if there's anything wrong with that data, if the matching is wrong, or if one entity has matched it one way and another entity has matched it the other way, or if you're not listed as a co-owner of the copyright in a certain market, or if a database somewhere has 120% of a copyright being claimed, which isn't possible, all of those things can result in money not getting through to the writer, getting stuck in the system maybe for years, or even worse, ultimately ending up in the big bad black box where the money then just slushes around and somehow gets shared out across the industry. So there are all of these issues for songwriters around bad data impacting on their income, on the royalties they receive. But one of the challenges for writers and their managers is, if they can't even see this data, how can they see where there are issues? How can they get those issues resolved?
So therefore, having more transparency on all that data is always a good thing and can help address some of the issues around the payment of song royalties. Some other collecting societies around the world have sought to make some music data more publicly available over the years, most notably in the US. And with this new portal that PRS is launching, it will be making it easier to see songwriter names and key codes for each song, plus what recordings have been matched to each song by PRS and its partners. Announcing the new portal last week, PRS said, "The recent Digital Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee's inquiry into the economics of streaming highlighted the need for greater availability and transparency of industry metadata and how improvements to the current systems were needed to accelerate the flow of royalties to music creators. By releasing this information, PRS for Music is determined to remove key barriers to the flow of royalties worldwide, ultimately improving the matching of sound recordings and musical works and increasing the speed and accuracy of royalty payments." It then went on, "This online tool will give songwriters, composers and music publishers greater visibility and increased control over their data, with the ability to search and download key data about their works. Importantly," it added, "it will also allow them to highlight any discrepancies. And not only that, the new tool will also give digital service providers access to writer information, facilitating more songwriter credits on streaming services."
Now, the initial plan, as announced last week by PRS, is to make data available through this new portal for about 2 million works that are sitting in the PRS database, with the promise that millions more works or songs will be added to the portal down the line. In terms of how many works we would ultimately want to see being listed and documented in that portal with all of that information, well, it has to be said, if you were to ask the question, how many songs are currently streaming on a platform like Spotify? Truth is, we don't really know. Because while people are always talking about those 70,000 tracks a day, or sometimes people say 80,000 tracks a day that are uploaded to Spotify, and we hear that Spotify has 70 million, actually now I think they claim 80 million tracks. I think Apple Music brags 90 million tracks. So there are stats about how many recordings there are on the streaming services. But of course, some of those recordings are going to be of the same songs, because lots of songs have been recorded more than once. So if there are 90 million tracks on Apple Music, it doesn't mean there are 90 million songs. But we reckon probably now somewhere between 30 and 35 million songs are available to stream. So if the Spotify portal opens with 2 million, quite a few more to be added down the line, but, you know, still a good starting point. Has to be said that a portion of the songs that are available on services like Spotify will have been written by DIY musicians, because while some self-releasing musicians do release cover versions of other people's songs, a lot of them are writing their own music, and therefore they are composing their own compositions and writing their own lyrics, etc., etc. And there is actually quite a high chance that a significant portion of the songs created by DIY musicians are not in anybody's database, because many of those DIY musicians, especially those who are kind of doing it more as a hobby, not because they want to become a full-time music maker, won't have a publisher, and they probably have never joined a collecting society, which means they're not putting any data into any system in order for the industry to know that that song exists. So the recording, and therefore the song, is happily streaming away on Spotify, but the system doesn't know the song exists. That also means that that musician is almost certainly getting zero song royalties, when technically they would be due song royalties. So it's great that PRS opening this portal. 2 million is a good starting point. It's great that they're committing to get millions more works in there. But in terms of us getting up to all 30, 35 million works that we suspect are on Spotify, available through portals like that run by PRS, and as we say, particularly in America, other societies have been making some of their data available through online portals for a while now. But how do we get those missing tracks? And that neatly brings us to the other announcement that was made last week by the US Collecting Society, the MLC.
Yes, so the MLC has launched what it's calling the Distributor Unmatched Recordings Portal, which it's calling DURP, which is fun. But more important than just having a fun name, it's a scheme that should allow artists currently missing out on some or all of their song royalties to get connected to that revenue stream. And as you said, with DIY artists in particular, there's a high chance that they won't be connected into that system and collecting those royalties. And a good way to try to identify what songs are contained in unmatched recordings is to consult the distributors that delivered those recordings to the streaming services, who in turn can then liaise with the artists that made them. And as you said, it's quite likely that the artist will have written the song themselves and won't be allied to any publisher or society to get their music into the system and claim their royalties. And the DIY distributors in particular are a really good point of contact to track down those artists and their music and make sure that they're in the system and the money that is due to them is flowing through to them.
So announcing that particular scheme over at the MLC was Dave Bogan, who is the society's head of third-party partnerships. And he said in a statement, "Our data has identified millions of dollars in unmatched digital audio mechanical royalties due to creators for songs they've recorded and released through more than 1,800 independent music distributors, aggregators and labels around the world. By giving these companies, which is to say the distributors, visibility into the data, we can help them serve their customers better and help the MLC reduce unclaimed royalties." So yeah, seems to me like a really good idea, and I do hope that the distributors embrace this new scheme set up by the MLC. Most of those distributors also have song right and royalty administration services to sell, so they do have an incentive to make sure those artists realise that their songs are not in the system and they're missing out on royalties, because then they can upsell them a service. So it isn't just those distributors doing it out of the goodness of their own heart, although I'm sure that they would. But anyway, two interesting developments last week, obviously. We're still to see quite how those work and what impact they have. But definitely, I personally think, to be welcomed. And I'm not the only person welcoming those developments.
Yeah, the UK's Music Managers Forum has been calling for more transparency around music rights data for years now via the Dissecting the Digital Dollar reports and guides that it's published in partnership with CMU. You might have heard us mention it once or twice. And therefore, it's unsurprising that the MMF has welcomed these two music data developments on both sides of the Atlantic. So MMF CEO Annabella Koldrick said last week, "The MMF, through our Digital Dollar Project, Song Royalties Guide and Manifesto, has long called for increased transparency from all parties in the song royalty chains so artists and writers can ensure they're being accurately paid. A big part of that is about making music data more readily available. We therefore applaud PRS's announcement to create an open song metadata portal to identify the writers behind each work and linking songs to recordings. We look forward to discussing how we can engage songwriter managers on its rollout in the new year." She then went on, "We also welcome the groundbreaking plan from the MLC in the US to work with music distributors to track down the writers of recordings that have never been matched to a song. We hope to see more proactive steps in this direction to greatly reduce the size and impact of the digital black box and ensure writers are paid their streaming royalties quickly and accurately."
And so I think it's safe to say that the MMF, just like us here at CMU, will be watching how these data initiatives evolve and get put into action very closely.
And finally, on this edition of Setlist, we're going to talk about Pusha T and how he has recorded not his first, but his second diss track trying to take down the McDonald's fast food chain. He has been doing this in partnership with rival fast food chain Arby's, and this time he's taking aim at the McDonald's McRib sandwich, having previously torn apart the Filet-O-Fish sandwich.
Yeah, so I guess we are used here in the world of CMU to pop stars and rappers doing deals with brands where they create content with those brands. That's something we write about and talk about a lot.
Yeah. We're used to them having feuds.
Exactly.
Well,
particularly within hip hop, we're used to rappers having feuds and then bringing those feuds into their lyrics and releasing diss tracks and response diss tracks. But it's not so often that those two sides of the music making world come together, which is why we are quite interested in this alliance between Pusha T and Arby's, a corporate partnership built on their communal disdain for the fast food chain that is McDonald's.
Yes, I did try to do some research to find out if there's a kind of history of corporate diss tracks, but I couldn't really find much. I think this might be a new genre that Pusha T has invented.
So, breaking new ground. As you noted in your write-up on this story in the CMU Daily, and you kind of alluded to at the start of this segment on Setlist as well, slightly annoyingly, the two McDonald's products that have been targeted with these corporate diss tracks so far, well, one is a pork product and one is a fish product, which means that we can't play around the beef thing going on here, because you'd think that a beef between Pusha T and Arby's and McDonald's would be focused on McDonald's many beef products, but yet to take aim at the classic Big Mac. Maybe that will be the third in the trilogy of corporate diss tracks.
Maybe he'll do a whole album.
I would like to hear that full album. But
would you?
No. And I haven't heard
Pusha T's a great rapper, but this isn't his best work, I don't think.
I read the lyrics that you included in the report in the CMU Daily. I didn't actually feel the need to click the link and go and listen to the tracks. But there is a bit of backstory, isn't there? This isn't just Pusha T out of the blue suddenly deciding that he hates McDonald's because he's being paid money by Arby's. There is a bit of backstory to Pusha T's beef with McDonald's that predates this brand partnership.
Yes, so there's a whole thing with the, you're aware of the McDonald's I'm loving it jingle.
Of course I am.
Now, Pusha T reckons that back in, that's been around since 2003, that jingle.
I look forward to Justin Timberlake taking it on a 20th anniversary tour next year.
Well, exactly, because that jingle is credited to Justin Timberlake and Pharrell Williams. But Pusha T has long maintained that he wrote it. And that's kind of why he's ended up working with Arby's on this. I don't know who contacted who first, but clearly someone saw the opportunity to do a brand partnership, and that's what happened. And when they released that first diss track earlier this year in March, he did an interview with Rolling Stone about it, and he claimed there, "I am solely responsible for the I'm Loving It swag and the jingle of that company. That's just real. I am the reason. Now I gotta crush it."
Now, some people dispute Pusha T's version of the creation of I'm Loving It.
Yeah, there's a whole... Pitchfork did a really... detailed article around the history of that jingle and Pusha T's claims about it, which is worth checking out. I'll link to that in the show notes.
He was involved in a track for McDonald's around the time that they launched that jingle. Is that...
Yes.
That's yes. True? We know that?
Yes. So back when they launched the jingle and it got stuck in everyone's heads, they ran a series of adverts, and some of them just had the little jingle. But one of those adverts had Pusha T rapping on it, you know, adding some extra words to it. The dispute is over whether that's all he did and he wasn't involved in the making of the jingle at all, or if he was right there at the heart of it when that jingle came up, which then Justin Timberlake whistled, and whether Pusha T lost out on what I imagine would be quite a lucrative credit.
Of course, it does seem like the beef really is with Timberlake and Williams rather than McDonald's, but I don't know. Maybe they think it was the suits at McDonald's that actually deprived Pusha T of his credit and his cut of the riches created by the I'm Loving It jingle. But hey, on the back of all of that, he's able to bond with this rival fast food chain and not only make some money from Arby's releasing these corporate diss tracks, but we reckon instigating an entire new genre of music and artist brand partnership strategies.
Yes, and like all of these fast food brand partnerships, because they come quite frequently, there's also a line of merch that goes alongside it. So if you want to show that you support Pusha T and Arby's, you can buy merch to do that. It's very expensive merch. I mean, far more expensive than it should be. But if that's how you want to spend your money in the middle of a cost of living crisis, who am I to stop you?
And at least once you've bought that merch, it will be clear to everybody which side you're on in the big old Pusha T and Arby's versus McDonald's, Timberlake and Williams battle. War? I don't know. What is it? Conflict of 2022.
Of course, Arby's doesn't exist in the UK, so it might confuse people if you're wearing that. You know, you've got to stand up for your principles, haven't you?
And I think we do have at least 6 listeners in the US. So this can be just for them. Andy will put a link just for you. So you've got to go and check this link out in the notes that accompany this podcast.
Yeah, don't make me do that work and then not click on it. I mean, what am I even here for? I'm not here anymore. Well, I am at the moment. But that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. That's what I'm trying to tell you. If you want to click on links, because we've mentioned quite a lot in this episode, you can go and find them all, everything we've discussed here and more, in your podcast player where you're listening to this right now, or at setlistpodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the show in that podcast player if you haven't already. Don't forget to rate and review the show. Don't forget, please don't forget, and tell a couple of friends about the amazing discussion you heard about corporate diss tracks. Tell them where you heard it, most importantly. And if you want to tell us anything, you can email us, setlist. Oh, and send us 2 cakes each. Was it each? Yeah, 2 cakes each. Email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.